Welcome to another World Cafe Words and Music podcast from WXPN and NPR Music. I'm David Dye. Our World Cafe guest today is Nick Lowe, the eminent British musician who started in the pub rock band Brinsley Schwartz in 1967 as the bass player and songwriter, went on to become the house producer for Stiff Records, recording the first five Elvis Costello records and writing What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding. He played with Dave Edmunds in Rockpile. Since then, he's had a solo career with two distinct parts, an earlier power pop start and a second, quieter, more adult second stage. He started in the mid-90s. That leads us to his latest album, The Old Magic, which was released on Yep Rock Records. I started our conversation off by asking him about those two distinct parts to his career and wondering which one he found more fulfilling.
Well, I relate a little bit more to the one I'm currently engaged on, because I'm back. It is an odd position I find myself to be in, to have a sort of second bite at the cherry, so to speak. And and when I listen to my old records, it although I sort of recognise them, it's a sort of different person in a way performing, because I was much younger and had quite a different sort of style. You know,
are you able to pinpoint what brought about the change?
Well, yes, I found myself at what I describe as the end of my brief career as a pop star, which finished really in about 81 or 82. As it happens to everybody, you know, if they're lucky enough to have a shot at all, they normally get a couple of years, 2 or 3 years, unless they're very unusual, you know, like Elton John or Cher or Neil Diamond or someone like that, who managed to have a careers that just span the decades. But most people, like myself, have a couple of years. And when I'd finished, and I knew it was coming up, the end of it was coming, because I'd been a record producer, so I'd sort of hung out with the boys upstairs kind of thing a bit whilst hanging with the artists as well. So I knew what was going to happen. But still, it comes as a bit of a shock when it actually does, and you can't get a table at a restaurant quite as easily, you know, and all the perks disappear. But on the other hand, I was kind of relieved as well, because I was quite ill, really. I was tired out and drinking far too heavily and all that other nonsense, you know. And so I was sort of relieved that it was over as well. But I found myself sort of with this thought in mind that here I was in my mid-30s, and I'd done pretty well. I had a couple of hits myself, and I'd written a couple of hits for other people, and I'd produced some good records that had done well. But now here I was on the scrap heap, really, and I thought that, well, I haven't really done anything that's really good, that I thought was really good. How am I going to do this in a business that doesn't really recognize anyone really over 40 and really in their 30s at that time? Now it's really common. So I started to think about how I could represent myself and get myself ready so that I could use the fact that I was aging in this business as a distinct advantage. And I knew it would take some time. I'd have to be very patient, because I figured I'd lose a large part of my audience. But I thought I'd gain another one, hopefully some younger folks. I thought if I get it right, I can get it hip, you know, and not just some old geezer's rubbish, you know, just make it hip and funny. And I was very keen on, I saw Johnny Cash's audience, and I thought, well, he's got it right. He's got three generations here of people, you know, grandparents, parents, and kids, and they're all here because they want to be here. And there's no one here under duress, like at a Jason Bieber concert, you know, where the parents all got their fingers in their ears. So I thought, well, I'm going to aim for that. And I've started to see signs that it's beginning to work.
But you needed to, it's like a plane on the runway, it has to take off. And you kind of needed that period of time to build into this new career. And I've heard you mentioned that the mailbox money from Peace, Love, and Understanding was kind of helpful in giving a little rise to your airplane, if we will kill a metaphor here.
There's absolutely no doubt that the check I received from the bodyguard was could not have come at a better time. And I spent it on at least getting a foot in the door, you know, because at that time, because I was spent as far as the business was concerned, I needed to sort of show myself, you know, to the public again when I had my first record in this style. And I was able to tour the United States, where I have, you know, a pretty good audience. And I was able to tour the States and stay in reasonable hotels, you know, and, you know, not top class, but right. reasonable, and pay my fellows some money, because I was quite broke, and they'd done the record for nothing, you know, so I got a chance to actually pay them. It was very, very welcome, this dough.
One of the things about this reinvention is the music moved into kind of a middle age. And it's funny how you define that, because I don't know if it's a current middle age or what we think of from the past, but there were certainly elements of pop music from the 50s, 60s, country music from that period of time. And that was a very conscious thing as well?
I suppose so, yes. I'm very anxious that I don't cop some sort of Nashville act, you know, sort of British-type Nashville act, even though I love that music and much other American popular music, including sort of Broadway tunes, you know, show tunes and show music and film music and things like that. But I'm very anxious that I just don't do some poor imitation, you know, of Nashville or Memphis or any of these, or New Orleans. But I love mixing and matching, and, you know, everything has been done now with the internet. You can get hold of any record that people used to search and search for. You know, it's just a couple of taps, you know, and you can get hold of anything. So the only thing that makes anything original now, in my view, is the mix that you put in the stew. You know, where you get your influences from, and how bold you wish to be in that area, to keep it funny, you know, and keep it entertaining.
Nick Lowe is our guest today on the Cafe, and you want to maybe start off with something from the early part of your Second Wind?
Yes, sure. What about I Live on a Battlefield?
Oh, great.
That's from The Impossible Bird.
Excellent.
I live on a battlefield, surrounded by the ruins of the love we built, and then destroyed between us. The smoke has cleared. As I stumble through the rubble, I'm daydreaming double, and I'm truly mystified. My new home is a shell hole filled with tears and muddy water, and a bit's a broken heart. All around there is desolation and scenes of devastation, of a love been torn apart. I live on a battlefield. I live on a battlefield. I live on a battlefield, the one where not one single drop of blood is spilled, is no less horrifying. Sweet, sweet memories of a bygone situation, now shattered, lord, and battered, lie scattered all around. My new home is a shell hole filled with tears and muddy water. Yes, and it's a broken heart all around. There is desolation and scenes of devastation, of a love been torn apart. I live on a battlefield. I live on a battlefield. Everything that can has gone wrong. I live on a battlefield. It's gonna take spine to carry on. I live on a battlefield. I'm like a drowning man coming up for air. I live on a battlefield. I'm looking for another survivor, but I can't see one anywhere. My new home broken heart. My world, my whole world is the one of a desolation, and the scenes of devastation, Lord, there is no consolation for a love been torn apart. I live on a battlefield. I live on a battlefield. I live on a battlefield. I live on a battlefield.
Nick Lowe, our guest today, and I Live on a Battlefield. Going back to the aforementioned Impossible Bird album. Who are some of the people you admire as songwriters?
Oh, my word, quite a lot. The one who springs, you know, immediately to mind is Arthur Alexander, I suppose. I loved his writing style, so natural and easy. And Johnny Cash, of course, and I used to think of Johnny Cash and Arthur Alexander as a sort of black and white version of each other, really, because they had this great... simple, very, very direct style and singing style as well. They sort of sounded like anyone could do it, you know, and of course...
And yet.
And yet, yes.
Well, speaking of Johnny Cash, you married his daughter, Carlene Carter, and so what was it like when you actually ended up pitching one of your songs to essentially your father-in-law?
Well, he actually did a couple of my tunes, but I imagine you're referring to The Beast in Me.
Absolutely.
Which I actually wrote for him. Mm-hmm. I thought the song up on the night before he was appearing in London at Wembley, and I stayed up all night. I had the idea for the first verse anyway, and thought it was a really fantastic idea for him, and I stayed up all night trying to finish this song off to play him the next day with the help of several bottles of wine. And by the time I staggered up to bed, I thought I actually was Johnny Cash. And I'd finished this song rather quickly, you know, and hadn't really given it much... I gave it lots of thought, but it was not very good, you know, apart from the very first verse. And the next day, when I woke up, I heard Carlene, my wife, Carlene Carter, telling him to come over and hear this song that I'd written. And of course, I knew that this was a bad idea. It wasn't right. Anyway, he turned up, but he turned up with, it seemed like he had the band, all the nursemaids and caterers and roadies and everyone with him as well. And they all crammed into our sitting room. And I was sort of wheeled out to sing this song very, very badly. And whereas the night before I'd sung this song, The Beast in Me, in this sonorous Cash style voice, The Beast in Me, had been echoing all over the house, you know, keeping everyone awake, I suppose. And I opened my mouth on this when everyone was in the room to sing it, and this little squeaky, "Oh, The Beast in Me," came out of my mouth. And it was appalling, you know, it was just terrible. And he made me do it again. You know, there was this terrible silence when I'd finished it in the room, you know, people occasionally coughing. Then he said, "Sing it again." And the second time was even worse. I mean, I never wanted to hear this thing again. You know, I was so embarrassed. But he thought that there was something there. And he was right, you know, because actually the first verse was good. But it was so traumatic, this experience of me singing this song to him. But every time I saw him after that, he'd always ask me about it. And sometimes he'd ask me with a bit of a twinkle in his eye, you know, and I thought he was having a joke at my expense because he knew, you know, that I'd made rather a hash of it. But anyway, on one occasion, in fact, it was the last occasion I saw him playing in London. I went to see him and he asked me about it. And that night I went home and just finished it, just like that. And I demoed it. In fact, the demo I did of it is the version that I used on my Impossible Bird record.
Very simple, very, yeah.
Yeah, and I sent it off to him, and I didn't hear anything else, and I thought, well, maybe he doesn't like it still, you know, but I knew it was good. You know, I did know it was a good thing. And the next thing I had was my stepdaughter, Tiffany, phoned me, and she'd been down to Jamaica to stay with them, and said she phoned me up and said that grandpa is playing it to anyone who comes to the house. And the next thing I knew, he cut it and put it on the American recordings. It was a tremendous thrill for him to do that.
Johnny Cash and Diana Ross. Good.
Yes. Well, Nick, it's very nice work if you can get it. You know. There's Nick, plenty of others that don't attract that attention.
Nick Love is our guest. I'd love to hear something from this new record. It's one of my favorites of the season. But there's a song in here called Stoplight Roses, which is an image everybody gets. Is it distinctly an American image, or are these guys selling in England and Europe as
Oh,
well?
Oh, yes, they did. In fact, I got the idea, you know, when someone approached me, you know, waving a great armful of these sad-looking things, you know, and I thought to myself, well, if you actually had... I thought, well, who buys these things, these flowers, you know, that they sell at these stoplights. And I thought, well, actually, if you're trying to sort of say I'm sorry, you know, and buy flowers for people like sometimes you do, and you gave them a bunch of these, it's a terrible sort of insult, really. And I thought, well, this could be a good idea for a song. But my main problem was thinking up a title, because we don't really say stoplight in Europe. We say traffic light, and that doesn't really sing very well, you know. And then I thought, well, stoplight, yeah, Stoplight Roses sounds about right.
And the song takes off from there. That image kind of says it all. Can you do that one?
Yeah, sure.
You've practiced and rehearsed it, but in your heart you know it's too late. Experience should tell you never get your story too straight. You'd better steel yourself and prepare for some blues to descend. 'Cause you've broken something this time. Stoplight roses can't mend. You've dusted off your shame face in the mirror behind the bathroom door. That little boy lost look that used to work so well doesn't anymore. If you believe your same old used to be, we'll see you through. You'll last about as long as stoplight roses do. Stoplight roses in their sad array. Love's promise in cellophane lace or dead giveaway. You'll need time to devise a stylish plan, and you'll do it driving over to Stoplight Roses man. And if you believe your same old used to be, we'll see you through. You'll last about as long as stoplight roses do.
Stoplight Roses, one of the new ones from Nick Lowe's The Old Magic, and Nick is live with us today. Hearing this on the record and hearing you do it, it's a very sad song, but yet, as you say, it's a funny song too, because this guy is so hapless. But
yes, I feel sort of an affinity for kind of hopeless people.
Definitely. Now, this character in The Sensitive Man, how does he relate to the Stoplight Roses character?
Well, I suppose he's a similar sort of person. There's a pattern developing here. Yes, sort of deluded.
In a delightful way.
Sensitive Man, here he is.
Lately when I go to steal a kiss, I feel you pulling away. I know something is amiss, but what it is you won't say. If I've done something to upset you, believe me, that was never my plan. But how can I fix it, standing out here in the cold? I'm a sensitive man. Yes, I am. You don't always have to speak. You can say it with a look. Even across a crowded room, darling, I can read it like a book. But other times when there's something on your mind, make it as plain as you can. Don't freeze me, baby, I'm no dinky-doo. I'm a sensitive man. I'm a sensitive man. You can hear that in my song. I'm a sensitive man. My first impressions could steer you wrong. Ba 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 da da ba. Sincerely, my one desire is to make you happy again. But I can't begin till you let me back in. I'm a sensitive man. I'm a sensitive man. You can hear that in my song. I'm a sensitive man. My first impressions might well steer you wrong. Sensitive man out in the cold, trying to do good, but so misunderstood. Sensitive man.
Sensitive Man, a new song from our guest today, Nick Lowe, live on the World Cafe, a song from his album, The Old Magic. We'll hear more old and new songs. I asked him about how he first met Dave Edmunds, his partner in the band Rockpile.
Well, he used to use the studio in Wales that Brinsley Schwartz used to use, Rockfield. And it was one of the first what they call residential studios. And when you go away and live at the place for 2 weeks or 3 weeks or however long you're going to make your record for. So you go away to this residential place. It's a bit like going to prison, in fact. And Edmunds would turn up. He was a real loner, you know. And I was a great fan of his from his I Hear You Knocking record. He made one album, which I think was called Rockpile, actually. And I used to see him come into the studio when we'd finished at night. He would turn up and stay there all night on his own. And I went out of my way to try and make friends with him, which I eventually managed to do. And then he started letting me sit at the back in the studio and watch him, you know, be an audience. And then he'd get me to go out and scratch a mic for him or do some menial task. And then one day he said, "What, can you go and do a backing vocal, you know, and save me doing it?" So I go and do a backing vocal for him or switch a machine on. And bit by bit, you know, we became more and more at ease with each other, or he became more at ease with me, until one day I brought him a song, you know, and said, what do you think of this? Do you like this? And he's, oh, yeah, I like that. Let's record it. So the two of us recorded and played everything on it. And then the next thing was Rockpile.
You talk about him playing everything. How did you end up the bass player in every band you were in?
That was from when I was at school. Funnily enough, with Brinsley Schwartz, I went to school with him. And he was a little older than me and had the school band. And nobody else wanted to play the bass or wanted to buy a bass. And so I jumped up, you know, said, well, I'll do it. And I didn't make it myself, but I had a friend who was quite good in the woodwork class, and he made me a bass, which was, you know, just about worked, you know.
Wow.
And it worked enough. And I got to quite enjoy it.
Yeah, the singing bass player, there's a lot of them, when you think of
it's a sort of a bad look, really. I think singing drummers look pretty cool, right? But a singing bass player, I think, is sort of bad look. It's rather unfortunate.
Nick Lowe is our guest, and we should put some more music in here. What would you want to do? Is there anything from Rockpile or anything in that era?
Yes, I can do one from the Rockpile record, yeah. Well, I can remember like it was only yesterday. Love was young and foolish, like a little child at play. But oh, how lovers change. Never dreamed how easily. For now I'm just a shadow of the boy I used to be. And oh, when I write a book about my love, it will be about a man who was torn in half, about his hope and ambition wasted through the years. The pain will be written on every page in tears when I write the book about my love. I was a fool to myself. Well, I kept on running round, and I fared a little better when I tried to settle down. Maybe some magic moments have I known, but not for long. For all too soon the magic was in a moment gone. And when I write the book about my love, it'll be a heartbreaking story of bad loving luck. When I get down on the pages, all that I felt, it's gonna make the hardest hearted book critic's heart melt. When I write the book about my love. When I was young, love was fun, and I was so happy. I looked so good, I dressed so snappy, two-tone shoes on my feet and a big old smile on my face. I was oozing and cruising all over the place. But now I'm town at heel and my complexion is bad, 'cause my love life is sad, boy, sad. But when I write the book about my love, it'll be a pop publication. There's a tougher than tough. When I get down on the pages, all that I missed, it's going straight to the top of the bestsellers list. When I write the book about my love, the book about my love, 1,000 words a day easily. I'm tapping at my typewriter, pulling it out and getting it down. The book about my love. When I write the book about my love.
We're helping Nick Lowe integrate all parts of his career on the World Cafe today, and that's Rock Pile Tune, When I Write the Book. He's got a very fine new album called The Old Magic. You were talking about working with Dave Edmunds at Rockfield and him kind of letting you in the studio. And was that your experience in production right before you started working for Stiff and doing that?
Yes, I learned a lot off Edmunds. There's no doubt about that. But I fell into record production really through my association with Stiff, purely because I'd been in a studio more than anybody else. And I was sort of up for having a go at it. But back in those days, if you want to be a record producer, all you had to do was to want to be one. Really, you didn't really have to have any skills. If you wanted to be one, you could. You didn't really have to know much technical stuff at all. It was all about man management and sometimes woman management as well, you know. But telling a few jokes and waving your arms around and being the sort of center of attention, really, a focus for the artist to and sort of cheerleader, you know.
But were the people who arrived at Stiff nervous? Did you have to do a lot of this kind of amateur psychiatrist thing?
No, actually. Most of the people who arrived at Stiff were very sort of pleased with themselves, considering that they had nothing going going for them. And we were all, you know, quite noisy.
Right. Now, was that how you met Elvis Costello to begin with, in your role as producer?
No, actually, I met him way before that. He was a fan of Brinsley Schwartz, and we used to see him at our gigs, especially whenever we played up near in the northwest, like Liverpool and Manchester. He used to come and see us, and we noticed him in the audience because he looked so distinctive. And there was a pub across the road as well, which everyone went in. All those Liverpool groups all drank in there, and at some point, when we played there, and I met Elvis in the Grapes. He went up to the bar, and I thought, well, we were sitting having a pre-gig drink, you know, and somebody said, oh, there's that kid who comes to see us, and I decided to introduce myself and buy him a drink. He claims that he introduced himself to me and bought me a drink, but that's a, you know, it's a mere detail.
What did you think of his songs when he started playing them for you?
Well, I thought they were too wordy. That's what I always used to. My criticism was always way too many words in here. I don't know what he's on about, and too many chords, too many words, too many chords, and I thought he could make life much easier. But he could make about three tunes out of one tune, and when I started out, you know, he listened to what I said, but gradually as he became more successful, our roles changed, you know, and he became much more dominant in the studio, and I wound up being this sort of forelock tugging, you know, yes, sir, Mr. Costello, sir, what are we doing today? You know, that's how we continued on. But he gets on asking me back again. I must have been doing something all right for him.
Well, so if we used to go watch you guys, then he was familiar with Peace, Love, and Understanding from Brinsley Schwartz?
Oh, well, I owe Peace, Love, and Understanding's success as a song, you know, totally to him, because that song would have gone the same way as the group, Brinsley Schwartz, you know, would have just faded away into history if it wasn't for him, because he'd heard us playing it in the Brinsleys, and when I was producing him, he said, let's cut a version of Peace, Love, and Understanding. And he was the one who, you know, gave it that anthemic thing, really, that that touched people. And it's been covered. I mean, I've had quite a lot of my songs covered, luckily. But that one has been covered so many times, I've lost count. All different. I mean, I've heard it done by African kids in, you know, sort of Tahitian fishermen, you know, as well as
it's a folk song, Nick.
Yeah.
Nick Lowe is our guest on the cafe today. We have time for one more. What would you like to do?
I'll try this one out. It might. it might work, it might not, but it's a sort of a little more, it's a rock and roll song. It's Raging Eyes.
Well, I know a little girl lives over there. She looks so square, but for a pair of raging eyes, oh, she's got a raging eye. She ain't such a beauty, hardly a Juliet, but she can roll a Romeo in to do his duty with those raging eyes, raging, raging eyes. She's got a raging eyes. Who wants to tell her raging eyes? Raging eyes, not this fella, raging eyes. Sometimes she's soft, sometimes she's scaly. Her mama said that even back when she was a baby, she had raging eyes. She had raging eyes. Cha 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 cha. Lights make them fiddle with the traffic. Sometimes she's mean as an M16 automatic. Whoa, she's got a raging eye. She's got a raging eye. Raging, raging eye. Siobhan, Siobhan. Siobhan, Siobhan. Siobhan, Siobhan, come on, light 'em up, baby. Siobhan, Siobhan.
Lovely. Raging Eyes, finishing up our session today with Nick Lowe. Always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, David.
Nick Lowe, the new album out now is The Old Magic. World Cafe Words and Music from WXPN and NPR Music is produced at WXPN in Philadelphia at xpn.org. Thank you for spending your time here with the World Cafe.